This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University, and today's program was prepared by Don Ulin. For Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
In sports this afternoon, the Toronto Raptors have officially introduced Jarrett Jack after signing him to a $20 million deal over 4 years. The Raptors signed the restricted free agent to an offer sheet on July 13th, giving the Indiana Pacers 1 week to match the offer. They opted not to, clearing the way for Jack to land in Toronto today. The Chicago Bulls have waived backup guard Anthony Roberson. He appeared in just 6 games with the Bulls and averaged 2 points after being acquired from the New York Knicks in February. The Chicago White Sox host the Tampa Bay Rays again tonight at U.S. Cellular Field. They've won 3 of 4 games since the All-Star break and 13 of their last 19. Rookie Clayton Richard gets the start tonight for the Sox. The St. Louis Cardinals look to bounce back from last night's loss as they take on the Astros tonight in Houston. Todd Wellmeyer will make his first start in almost 2 weeks for St. Louis. He's 7-7 on the season. And Rich Harden and the Chicago Cubs will try to halt the Philadelphia Phillies' 9-game win streak tonight at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia. Harden is 6-6 this season, but he's 4-1 and 6 games away from Wrigley Field. That's sports.
The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana.
It's 2:42. When we talk about the mortgage crisis, we often tell stories from California, Florida, or Nevada, which are the states hardest hit by the mortgage crisis. But when it comes to failed banks, Georgia has more than any other state. Since last August, 15 banks there have shut down. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
There's no panic in Georgia due to the number of failed banks, but it is causing some to pause and change how they operate. Take the city of Douglasville, Georgia, about 20 miles west of Atlanta. The crepe myrtle trees lining the streets in front of City Hall are laden with white, flowery branches. The railroad tracks are nearby. It's a quaint picture of a southern city that's still growing. But people here are especially careful these days. Reports surfaced that the bank the city had used for years could be in jeopardy, and officials decided to take action.
We just felt like it was prudent because of the unfavorable report on this bank that we should not sit idly by and just wait to see what might happen, that we should be proactive.
City Manager Bill Osborne says Douglasville removed $9.4 million from the Douglas County Bank and now has its funds in 10 different banks.
At points past, you may have been more concerned with how do we get the highest interest rate, but now it's how do we make sure that the funds are available when we need them.
The bank in question, Douglas County Bank, has been operating under intense federal oversight since January as a result of its risky financial condition. The bank has not failed. About 60 other Georgia banks are also operating under similar restrictions. Here's what happened. Atlanta is one of the fastest growing areas of the country, and there's been great demand for real estate development. Many new banks sprang up, and they needed deposits to make loans. So they got what's known as hot money, large deposits from brokers who search for banks paying the highest interest rates. The problem is that money can leave the bank as fast as it came in.
The bankers aren't stupid. They knew that there was risk.
Walter Melling has been a banking attorney in Atlanta for 40 years. He says Georgia may have suffered the most, not because housing prices soared, but because residential and commercial property markets continued to be quite profitable until mortgages completely dried up in 2007.
We had faster growth in this market. We had more new banks in this market, and they were dependent on growth. And when the growth stopped, when the cakewalk ended, they were vulnerable.
Another issue is declining commercial real estate values, especially in outlying areas. Joe Brannon with the Georgia Bankers Association says banks are being forced to take unreasonable losses.
We have one example of a bank branch that was closed that the appraised value came back as nothing. There's a building, there's a lot, They're trafficked by it. Now, you can't tell me that that's worth nothing. That's where the significant problem occurs.
President and CEO of the Independent Community Bankers of America, Camden Fine, has called Georgia the Chernobyl of banking, not because banks didn't operate well, but because he says regulators are coming in too quickly to shut them down.
The bank examiners have not been giving community bankers time to work through these loan problems. They've just been hammering them very, very hard, and in some cases forcing them into receivership. And I just don't think that's right.
But examiners are enforcing regulations that all banks must follow and trying to protect depositors. And regulators are not just closing down Georgia banks. Institutions in California, Florida, and Arizona are facing similar problems. Banking analysts predict perhaps another 100 banks could fail nationwide in the second half of the year. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
A former NFL player wants to build the world's first 100% solar-powered city. He's billing it as the world's most sustainable city as well. Rebecca Williams visited the planned site of this new city to find out how green real estate can get.
Sid Kitson used to be number 64, an offensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers. Now he's a developer with an even bigger dream for fame. He bought a 91,000-acre ranch in southwest Florida called Babcock Ranch. He sold more than three-quarters of it back to the state for a nature preserve. The rest will become a city of 45,000 people.
It's a place where business, education, technology, energy, transportation, and safety all merge into an exceptionally livable, environmentally sensitive community.
It might sound like he's packing a lot in, but the plans don't end there. The video tour shows you a glittering utopia. Little animated people glide by on sailboats and Segway scooters. You'd get to work in your electric car and plug it in while you're at work. You'd be harvesting rainwater. You'd go camping on the nature preserve. And pretty much everything would run on the sun. Sid Kitson says what'll make the city even greener is that it'll meet all of your needs.
The whole idea of Babcock Ranch is that you don't leave, that you have everything you need in Babcock Ranch. And that's not saying people aren't going to want to drive to Disney World or go to the beach or do other things like that. But for the daily needs, for when they go to work, when they go shopping, where they have to normally get in their car and drive 20 miles or 30 miles or an hour or 20 minutes or whatever, they can do it right there in their hometown.
Kitson's proud to say he's won over a lot of local environmental groups, but his city of the future has its skeptics. The Florida Sierra Club sued to stop the sale of the land. Kitson and partners ended up settling the lawsuit, and the deal went forward. Frank Jackalone is with the Sierra Club. He says he does like the plans for solar power, and the city looks pretty well planned out. But he says once development starts, it usually doesn't stop.
Even the best planned community could be swallowed up by a sea of urban sprawl, of roads, of shopping malls, of poorly planned development that surrounds it, that creates the very nightmare that environmentalists fear the most.
Jackalone says it'd be better to invest in older cities and retrofit for solar power. He says it'd be better to keep the land intact for Florida wildlife like bears and panthers. Sid Kitson says he does respect that point of view.
And we hope that at the end of the day, that they'll look at it and say, you know, would have loved to have had it all preserved, but, you know, they did a great job here.
The solar city is supposed to get underway within the next few years, but reality is blocking the dream. Right now, Babcock Ranch is still just a ranch with grazing cows and watermelon fields. The huge 75-megawatt solar plant that would power the city hasn't been built yet. The Florida legislature still has to approve it. And, of course, there's the little issue of the recession. The solar city is planned in a county with one of the highest foreclosure rates in the nation. Kitson says these are just temporary hurdles.
It'll take time, but we think eventually the housing market will come back, and this will be a place where we think people want to look first to live.
In fact, he thinks all developers are going to have to build in a greener way.
I think that if any developer out there or any builders who aren't thinking about doing it in an environmentally responsible way are really going to miss the boat on what's going to be happening when we come out of this recession.
But as Kitson himself has found, even the world's most sustainable city is still a city. There will always be opposition from someone who thinks the greenest way to build a city is to rebuild an old city. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
U.S. ports are among the biggest sources of air pollution in the cities they're in. Some ports are making progress in cleaning up their emissions, but critics say the pace of cleanup is too slow. Lisa Ann Pinkerton has this report.
The Matson Line cargo ship is laden with hundreds of shipping containers, and it looks like a floating building rather than a ship. It's in from a recent trek across the Pacific Ocean, and it's docked here at the Port of Oakland. It's being unloaded one container at a time by a row of cranes towering over the ship.
And they're either loading them onto a truck chassis to go directly out of the port, or they're going to store it in the yard, sort it out, and put it on a rail car or send it out on the regional freeways.
That's Richard Sinkoff. He directs environmental projects at the Port of Oakland. He says it can take crews 24 to 48 hours to fully unload one ship. And all that activity creates a lot of air pollution surrounding West Oakland. The trucks moving containers around the port run on diesel. And recently, the port banned all pre-1994 trucks from shuttling shipping containers. Daphne Prevost, who manages truck programs for the port, says the goal is to ensure the thousands of trucks serving the port emit low levels of diesel pollution.
These are engine model years that we're talking about, and generally the older the engine, the more polluting it is. Like anything else, trucks get cleaner as, you know, technology for truck engines gets cleaner.
Los Angeles has done this too, and it's the biggest port in the country. Since last fall, it's removed 4,500 dirty trucks from its operations. Richard Abbey says the region's seen a nearly 35% improvement to the local air quality and a reduction of 500 tons of nitrous oxide, or NOx.
And to put that in perspective, that 500 tons per year of NOx is like removing 113,000 cars from the road for a year.
But truck exhaust represents only about 4% of all diesel emissions in America's ports. It's the ships that emit the most. They burn dirty bunker fuel on their way into the port, and when they're docked, they keep it running for electricity. James Cannon is with Energy Futures, an environmental advocacy group. And he says these big ships are just like a power plant on land. But because they're in the water, the U.S. Clean Air Act doesn't apply.
But because the power plant is just a few feet off the berth on the ship, it's totally unregulated. And this has led to emissions literally thousands of times higher than would be allowed if it was just a few feet away.
Cannon says ports are exploring ways to cut these emissions, but the pace is slow. He says the most ideal solution is to allow ships to plug into the electrical grid while at berth. A few ships docking at the Port of Long Beach can do this now. These California ports are greening their operations because state law is pushing them. Cannon says America's seven other ports have much farther to go. He says they should take advantage of the lower shipping activity during this recession and spend money to green their operations.
Rather than endlessly expanding their container ports for endlessly expanding volume, they now have a chance to kind of restructure their ports and put them on a cleaner basis.
The U.S. EPA has pledged to regulate air within 230 miles of U.S. coasts by 2012. And if the agency stays true to its word, all the nation's ports will have to green their operations eventually. Whether it will be as much as California's ports have done remains to be seen. For the Environment Report, I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton.
Studies from NASA and many other U.S. agencies report the Arctic ice is melting at a rapid rate. Scientists say it's the most visible and dramatic evidence of global warming. One of the symbols of climate change is the Arctic polar bear. Lester Graham talked with the senior scientist studying polar bears, who's with the U.S. Geological Survey, Stephen Armstrup, about the future of the polar bear.
Well, we believe that in the long term, polar bears are in trouble because of the projected changes in the sea ice resulting from global warming. Polar bears are entirely dependent on the surface of the sea ice to capture their prey, which are principally ringed seals and bearded seals. And as the sea ice area declines and as it's gone for longer periods of time, that, in essence, is a decline in the carrying capacity of the environment for polar bears.
Now, how much have polar bear populations declined?
We only have really good information on the trend in numbers for just a couple of populations. The best known are the ones in the southern Beaufort Sea of Alaska and the western Hudson Bay of Canada. And there we've documented that the populations are apparently declining now and suggests that they will be continuing to decline in the future.
I'm wondering, can we, regular everyday folks, do anything to help the polar bears?
Well, our studies were pretty conclusive that greenhouse gas contributions were the principal threat to polar bears. This was recently reaffirmed in the latest meeting of the polar bear specialists that met in Copenhagen. And so if you take that to heart, you can say, what is my responsibility as an individual to do what I can to reduce my greenhouse gas footprint? And I think that's where it really starts, is people taking individual responsibility for the way that they live. And, of course, it goes beyond greenhouse gases. It's, what is our total footprint on the environment in terms of the amount of pollutants, the amount of waste that we create, whatever. Each individual has a certain amount of responsibility to monitor their impact on the environment in that way.
You know, down here in the lower 48, I've only seen polar bears in a zoo, animated ones in Coca-Cola commercials. There's a little bit of a disconnect. You have written dozens and dozens of scientific papers about the polar bear. I'm wondering why you think we should care about them, and why do you care about polar bears?
Yeah, I've been studying polar bears for 28 years, and the studies involve going out over the sea ice with a helicopter, searching for bears. And after doing that for 28 years, I can still say that every field season, the first polar bear we see, it's this, wow, there's a real wild polar bear. They're just magic creatures, and I don't know that I can put my finger on exactly why I'm so impressed with polar bears. Technically, it's their ability to survive in this harsh environment and their great beauty as they move across that harsh environment. And as a scientist, my role is to try and collect the information, the technical information, that will allow managers and policymakers to make the best decisions possible regarding the future of the polar bear.
Stephen Amstrup is the senior polar bear scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
I'm Lester Graham.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation and the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
Earth and sky.
There's no single silver bullet in terms of a new renewable energy that one can simply flip a switch and say, we're going to do this now and we're going to go renewable.
You're listening to Joe Powell, Chief Scientist of Chemical Engineering at Shell. Dr. Powell researches ways to develop renewable energy. He said that while fossil fuels dominate the world's energy of today, he sees a shift coming to energy like biofuels, wind, and solar.
It's already a portion of the energy spectrum today, and we're looking in the 50 to 100 year